This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
people must absolutely not panic. We're not bringing back here people who have coronavirus. These are people who are very well, who are fine. Nobody has coronavirus.
That is South African Ministry of Health spokeswoman Dr. Lwazi Manzi on the country's decision to repatriate more than 130 South Africans from Wuhan. Also, Nigeria has reported its first case of the virus, and Tunisia's parliament has approved a coalition government. We'll have that and more right here on the English Africa service of Voice of America. Today, the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said that based on the latest developments, the agency raised the COVID-19 virus risk assessment to the very high at a global level. This comes the same day Nigerian officials confirmed a case of coronavirus in the country, the first in sub-Saharan Africa. Africa is braced for a potential coronavirus pandemic, as experts warn that health systems on the continent could be overwhelmed. However, experts say that apparent delay in the virus reaching Africa has given health officials precious time to prepare, as Henry Ridgewell reports.
Nigerian officials say the confirmed case is an Italian national who works in Nigeria and returned to Lagos from Milan, Italy, earlier this week. He is now being treated in a Lagos hospital and is said to have no serious symptoms. The case has raised fears of a potential coronavirus outbreak in one of Africa's most densely populated cities. Single cases of the coronavirus have been detected in Egypt and Algeria, but so far there has been no large-scale outbreak on the continent. The World Health Organization's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, warned Thursday that no country can assume it is safe from the virus.
This virus does not respect borders. It does not distinguish between races or ethnicities. It has no regard for a country's GDP or level of development. The point is not only to prevent cases arriving on your shores. The point is what you do when you have cases.
The apparent delay in any African outbreak has given the continent time to prepare. Until this month, only two laboratories in the whole of Africa were able to test for the coronavirus. The World Health Organization says now more than half of sub-Saharan countries are equipped to diagnose the virus. Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo is from the John Hopkins Center for Health Security.
It's not as extensive as we need it to be, and the testing that's going on in countries isn't as complete as we'd like it to be. But the fact that we've been able to stand this up in relatively short amounts of time, I think it represents progress.
It's feared that an undetected outbreak could rapidly escalate into a health crisis. Around 80% of people with the coronavirus have only mild symptoms, meaning the true prevalence is likely underreported. Most fatalities have occurred in those with underlying health problems. But a pandemic in Africa would overwhelm medical facilities, says Dr. Natalie McDermott of King's College London.
It's an issue when it comes to managing other medical problems. So that means that people with heart disease and things aren't necessarily able to visit the hospital or to get an appointment. And subsequently, we could see increased mortality from other medical problems simply because they can't access the health system.
Experts say many African nations must improve disease surveillance and operations to trace the spread of infection. They also warn that in the event of a global pandemic, the international community must be ready to step in and help countries with weaker health systems. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The coronavirus outbreak in China already is affecting businesses in other parts of the world, including Nigeria. Thousands of Nigerian merchants travel to China each year to import products, but Nigerian authorities have called on business people to restrict travel to China until the virus is contained. Timothy Obezu reports from Abuja.
Abuja trader Osita Chukwu started his furniture and generator business 20 years ago with less than $200. Chukwu has grown the business to the point where he imports most of his wares from China. He travels there several times each year to close deals or purchase products from manufacturers. But now, the coronavirus is affecting business as usual, and he's running out of stock.
For now, the goods are no more coming as supposed to be coming as used to become before. So, and it's affecting us very well. The ones we have on ground, we have to add a little money on it to sell, because if you sell at the rate you bought before, I want to buy another one, it will be increased. Even the one that you have ordered before, it cannot come in now, because everywhere about it now is closed.
Nigeria and China are major trade partners. In 2018, Nigeria imported about $7 billion worth of goods from China. Development economist Emeka Okengwu says the coronavirus's impact on trade between Nigeria and China should be temporary.
It could have some little impact, if you may, okay? Because there are some deals you need to close, eyeball to eyeball, you know, that might not happen, especially, you know, in some areas of China, okay? But it's not going to stop international businesses. It will affect some part of it, no doubt, but it's not going to be sustained.
China has a growing number of nationals working and living in Nigeria. And that's one reason the World Health Organization has listed Nigeria as one of 12 African countries at high risk from the coronavirus threat. Nigerian authorities have advised citizens to avoid travel to China and are strengthening surveillance at borders and ports. China's ambassador to Nigeria says both governments are working together to prevent any coronavirus outbreak.
Fighting the spread of epidemic is a common concern of the international community. China is willing to work with other countries in the world, including Nigeria, to respond to the epidemic actively.
Until the virus is contained, businessmen like Chukwu may have a hard time doing business unless they seek alternatives. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And from Nigeria, we'll go to South Africa, where South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says that he has directed officials to repatriate more than 130 South Africans from Wuhan, the epicenter of the global coronavirus epidemic. Officials stress that no one in the group has tested positive for the virus and that health officials will put them under quarantine when they get home. Still, the decision contradicts official Chinese advice that if foreigners in Wuhan will fare best if they remain in place. The move comes as global deaths begin to grow. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Of the 199 South African citizens in the Chinese city, 132 have asked to come home, according to the president's office. All are currently in lockdown in Wuhan as the virus spreads. However, the presidency made clear in a statement late Thursday night that they should not expect a no-strings-attached homecoming. Upon arrival, they will be placed in a 21-day quarantine. None of them, the president's office noted, have been diagnosed with the virus or shown any symptoms. While the president's office did not answer numerous calls seeking comment and did not say when people might begin to return, Ministry of Health spokeswoman Dr. Lwazi Manzi told VOA that officials have one strong message for South Africans. Don't panic.
People must absolutely not panic. We're not bringing back here people who have coronavirus. These are people who are very well, who are fine. Nobody has coronavirus. They are people who have requested to come home for various reasons. Some of them are students who finished their studies. Some of them are people who finished whatever they're doing in business or in leisure, and they really just need to get back home and get out of the lockdown conditions in Wuhan. And also just to sort of reiterate that we are bringing back citizens from Wuhan, from that epicenter, who are under lockdown. We are bringing them back upon their request so that they can, continue with their lives that they were living here in South Africa.
Africa has been largely spared, as more than 82,000 people have been infected worldwide since the virus began to surface late last year. Most of the cases are in China. Nigeria this week reported its first confirmed case. South Africa's National Institute for Infectious Diseases applauded the move to repatriate South Africans and stressed that there have been no confirmed cases yet in South Africa. The Institute's Dr. Kerrigan McCarthy says authorities continue to monitor the situation.
To date, there have been no confirmed cases of COVID-19 in South Africa, and the NICD continues to test for possible cases. 133 persons to date have been tested for SARS-CoV, of whom 89 met the case definition for persons under investigation as of the 28th of February. We continue to monitor trends of COVID-19 globally and in the African region to improve our knowledge of the disease and to continually enhance our surveillance and response.
Additionally, South Africa's government has implemented temperature testing and health screening at the continent's busiest airport. The nation's health minister has assured the population that the government has contingency plans in place, including designated treatment facilities and a 24-hour hotline. Manzi added that two South African nationals are being treated in Japan after testing positive for the virus on the Princess Diamond cruise ship. However, she added, both patients are asymptomatic and will be kept under medical care until they are fully recovered. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Tunisia's parliament has approved Prime Minister-designate Elias Al-Fayyah's new coalition government. Legislators voted 129-77 yesterday in favor of Al-Fayyah's team. This was not the first time that legislators in Tunisia voted for a coalition government, but the nature of coalition created some problems in the past. The National Unity Government of 2015-2019 abandoned controversial but necessary issues like transitional justice and security sector reform and could not take bold action on the economy or formation of the Constitutional Court. VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi spoke with Radwan Masmoud, president of Tunisia's Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy, about the end of the political crisis and the beginning of facing tough challenges in the only success story in the Arab Spring.
I think this will end the Tunisian, the crisis in Tunisia, which we've had for about 4 months since the elections, which were held in October. This is very positive step that we were able to finally agree on a government. Finally, the coalition is there, and we now have a government that will have the support of the parliament and will hopefully manage to implement the reform. Unfortunately, the government does not have a huge majority behind it. To implement some of these of the needed reforms, it will need a bigger coalition and a stronger support from some of the parties that are currently in the opposition. But I think this is doable, and I think that Tunisians are looking forward to implementing the needed reform and to moving the economy forward and to becoming more competitive economically. So this is definitely a very positive step in the new opening for Tunisia.
But the approval of Al-Fayyah's administration comes as cash-strapped Tunisia needs $3 billion to cover government expenditure in 2020. Unemployment has remained stubbornly high at 15%. A previous deal with IMF to grant Tunisia $3 billion was signed in 2016 in return for major concessions, including floating of the Tunisian currency. That resulted in a steep increase in the price of basic commodities and slashed the purchasing power of ordinary Tunisians. What is the way out?
I think the reforms that are called for by the IMF agreement are very, very difficult to implement in Tunisia right now. And if they are implemented, there is a very high risk of popular uprisings and popular anger, you know, becoming so high that it might derail the democratic transition in Tunisia. So I think the way out is really for the international community to stand by Tunisia, to support Tunisia. This is the only nascent democracy in the entire Arab world. I think the world community needs Tunisia to succeed, to prove that democracy can succeed in the Arab world and can deliver good results. But it takes time. And reforming the economy, reforming the political system, reforming the laws in Tunisia, and we hope that the international community and anyone who really wants democracy to succeed will stand by Tunisia and will not derail these very important experiments with democratic transition in Tunisia by forcing these issues and these reforms at a very fast pace and untenable situation economically in Tunisia today.
Dr. Masmoudi, this was not the first time the legislators in Tunisia voted for a coalition government. But the nature of coalition created some problems in the past. The National Unity Government of 2015-2019 abandoned controversial but necessary issues like transitional justice and could not take bold action on the economy. Is coalition a serious concern?
Even though there were some shortcomings in the past 5 years under the National Unity Government, there was also a lot that was achieved in this period of time, including political stability, including a lot of important reforms in the security sector. Tunisia has been able to defeat the threat of extremism and of terrorism in Tunisia. The security system is now much, much better and much stronger than it was 4 or 5 years ago. Now, one of the reforms that I think Tunisia needs to implement is to reform the electoral system to encourage smaller parties to unite and to merge together and to become the main parties in Tunisia. This will help to have stronger political parties in Tunisia and will be able to implement these reforms and to build a stronger government that has a clear vision and clear program.
That was Radwan Masmoud, president of Tunisia's Center for the Study of Islam and Democracy. He was speaking to VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi. A diplomatic dispute has arisen between Mali and France. Today, Mali's foreign minister, Tibile Drame, is in Paris to meet with French leaders to try to calm tensions between the two allies in the fight against extremism in the Sahel. Journalist Catherine Field is in Paris, and she has been covering the story. She spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson a short time ago to fill us in on the dispute.
The upper house of the French Parliament, the Senate, had a meeting. The Foreign Affairs Committee met on Wednesday. And at that meeting, there were the five ambassadors from the G5 Sahel nations. It was a regular follow-up from that January summit in Pau, which the French President Emmanuel Macron had restated French determination to stay engaged in the Sahel. So it was really just a sort of keeping everyone informed of where everyone was up to with that. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Mali's ambassador started talking about soldiers that were running amok in some parts of Bamako. He said that there were all sorts of, he said you can see them, and I'm quoting here, tattoos all over their bodies, rendering an image that is not one we know of the French army. Now, quickly, everyone got onto this and pointed out to him that there are no French legion based in Bamako. They're all right out in the Sahel region, and that perhaps he had got mixed up or something. But he stuck with it, and that was really when not just the French Foreign Ministry and not just the Parliament, but also the Defense Ministry got really angry because they felt that he was spreading lies, creating distrust, not just between France and Mali, but also within Mali itself, where there is still this residual distrust of what France is really doing in the region.
So what are the French saying officially right now?
Officially, they're absolutely livid. Officially, the spokesman for the head of the army said they didn't expect this sort of remark from an ally. They said that it would be best that rather than propagating false accusations, that Mali ambassador should mobilize all his action for the implementation of decisions from that January summit in Pau. So that's what they're saying publicly, and also publicly they are saying that they remain committed to the Sahel. That having been said, behind the scenes, they're absolutely furious and pointing out the fact that at that January summit, French President Macron made it very clear to all the five leaders of the Sahel, the G5 Sahel, that it was French troops that were there that were French soldiers from French families who were giving their lives to ensure the sovereignty of those five Sahel nations.
Now, is this incident likely to have any lasting effect on the French support for the G5 Sahel and for the effort to control militants in the region?
France has made it very clear they're in the G5 Sahel for the long haul. They are, of course, concerned that counter-terrorist activities across those five Sahel nations is increasing. They do realize that there is still this threat that these groups will push deeper into sub-Saharan Africa. But France is still saying they're there for the long haul. They realize the importance of security in that area. But you know, whether we're talking about today or tomorrow, French pulling back, that's highly unlikely. In fact, this may well increase in France the need for them to come up with more results, because there is this underlying suspicion that France isn't getting on top of the security issue in the Sahel.
That was Catherine Field in Paris speaking with editor Kate Pound-Dawson. And still in Paris, Reuters news agency reports that French police evacuated the Gare de Lyon railway station in Paris a short time ago after a major fire broke out on the street next to the station. News agencies say the fire began during a protest of a concert by Congolese singer Fally Ipupa. After a long and unsettling dry spell, the water at Zimbabwe's Victoria Falls is flowing again, fed by rains upstream in Angola and Namibia. But as Columbus Mavunga reports, experts and environmentalists say global warming is having a huge impact across Africa, and the continent needs to take immediate action to help reverse the trend.
Nkosilati Nyati, a 17-year-old environmental activist from this resort town of Victoria Falls, says he will not tire until world leaders unite to reduce air pollution and greenhouse gases that are causing global warming.
Now time to act. It's now time to use renewable energy and actually mitigate against climate change. From 50 years from now, what will be my environment if I don't mitigate today? So it's now time to act. To the world leaders, what I'm saying is, it's now time to act. Act how? Include the youth in your policy making, because those are the people which are on the ground. People are actually feeling the heat of climate change.
Nyati is now a high school student. At his former school, Shemabondo, he was part of the Ozone Defenders Club, which created a biogas station in 2016 that is now being used to prepare food for the students.
As a club, what we decided is why don't you use clean energy so that we can actually show the world that clean energy is actually something which we can put in practice. So the biogas station is actually supporting the food scheme project. It's actually being used for cooking.
Nyat hopes that with more funding, Chemambondo School and other schools nationwide can move away from using firewood as part of efforts to curb deforestation in Zimbabwe. On the sidelines of a regional sustainable development forum, James Murombezi, the officer in charge of the United Nations African Climate Policy Center, says the continent must invest in researching climate change and building resilience as Africa is bearing the brunt of global warming.
Here in Southern Africa, we know that this is going to be one of the most affected regions. It is going to get drier and it is going to get hotter. Already we have witnessed these impacts on the Zambezi River system. It has been drying, and some projections are actually that Zambezi might lose up to 20% of its water by 2050, which is not very far from now. If that happens, then Kariba Dam, for instance, is going to lose up to 60% of its generation capacity.
And that's it for this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Have a great weekend, everyone.